Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is August 1st, 2006, and today's session is entitled Five Commandments for Understanding the Human Heart, presented by Jonathan Frakes, number FRJ-2006-02. Let's listen in.
This is the start of the second session in this series called Risking Loving the Holy Land from Pax to Faith. This session I'm calling Five Commandments for Understanding the Conflict. And my name is Jonathan Frakes, and I'm working for the World Council of Churches in the advocacy unit of the World Council of Churches, responsible for the Middle East and disarmament. During the course of the session, there are going to be three things that might help. One is I'm going to refer back to the golden piece of paper I passed out yesterday as an example of what I'm talking about today. It fulfills one of the five commandments pretty nicely, I hope. Another one is we're going to show you a map, which might help with some of the questions we had yesterday where people aren't quite clear on what's been happening on this much-promised land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea coast. And then, what was the third thing? I can't remember. I'll remember when I get to it. It was interesting that yesterday, Barb Rossing used a thing which is reputedly part of Luther's legacy to us, and I'm with the woman who remembers Luther saying it. If the world's going to end tomorrow, I'm going to plant an apple tree today. I think it wasn't just a tree, it was an apple tree. No? Yeah, in Germany. Okay, if the world's going to end tomorrow, and you know it, you're still going to plant an apple tree today, because I think that's really the spirit that we have to approach these intractable problems that are so bad they make people think about the end of the world. And make some people get all eager to help God do that. Okay, go to Bible study tomorrow and hear more about that. I was reminded of this on the top of the Mount of Transfiguration, Mount Tabor, in Galilee, in my very first visit to the Holy Land, by meeting another monk, not Luther, not a Dominican, but a Franciscan monk, who was planting geraniums. It was real clear, though, that this wasn't quite such an innocent scene, because this guy in his brown Franciscan robe. And don't you envy these guys who can go about their whole life just wearing one brown robe, not to worry about the kind of things we worry about? He was angry as hell. He was just as angry as hell. And I was a little shocked because it wasn't my image of a monk. I'm just an innocent Protestant. I admire Catholic people who take rites and holy orders. Well, he was mad because the church properties that he has there, the Franciscans are the custodians of the holy sites. And they've been doing that since the Crusades. So they had kind of a bad beginning, kind of an invasion and a war, but they've been doing good work ever since, okay? And he was mad as hell because these church properties are under extreme threat. And remember, this is 1991, and everything I'm saying is still true and more true today. And because the world that he served was ending. Little by little, house by house, olive grove by olive grove, emigrating family by emigrating Christian Palestinian family, his world was ending. His Palestinian parishioners were disappearing in front of his eyes. And these guys come and work sometimes for their whole lifetime in a place like Palestine. I can't remember his nationality. I think he was German. But he was hard at work touching up creation. And so that the deep blue sky of Galilee and the pearly white of the limestone rocks that grace the whole area were beautifully augmented and supplemented by the bright red of the geraniums and the dark green leaves that geraniums have. I'd like to have us address our steps on this journey that makes a little sense to me between from facts to faith. From facts to faith. Address the first steps on that journey from on top of Mount Tabor, under that bright blue sky, and with that challenge of an angry monk working in a garden. When you stand on top of that mountain, it's at the south of the Sea of Galilee, you can just do a 360 degrees, and in one turn of your body, you can see Syria over here, the Golan Heights here, the snows of Mount Hermon. These are all in the Bible. All these names are in the Bible. The Sea of Galilee itself at your feet, and spinning around some more, the Jordan River, and then we always talk about the West Bank. Well, with the East Bank is the other side of the Jordan River, and it's part of the country of Jordan, and it quickly bleeds off into kind of badlands of the Jordanian desert. That's sort of the creation that you see, But then, of course, you also notice things like the Horns of Hittim. Anybody know the Horns of Hittim? There's an incredible crusader battle there between the Muslim forces and the crusaders at the Horns of Hittim. It's a peculiar-looking hill. Looks like two horns or several horns, where I think the Muslim forces prevailed over the crusader forces. You can see the rich farms of Galilee, beautiful piece of landscape. And, of course, that other place, a little hill called Megiddo, which we all know as Armageddon. And this, if you go to the Bible studies again, this is what the kind of place that really gets Tim LaHaye and his friends salivating, because that's where the world's going to end. So you can see that from the top of this Mount of Transfiguration. And that's also worth pondering, a place where we honor the transfiguration of our Lord. For me, the journey from facts to faith kind of goes by these three chapters. First, you've got to understand. Then you've got to trust. Break out of your despair. Break out of your ignorance. Break out of your lethargy, your passivity. And then get on with something where your faith and your action are indistinguishable. Because I think really faith and action are indistinguishable. I think that we know one without the other is dead. And that's also something to remember. A place like Mount Tabor for me is a place where you can have a clear head and a long view, a view into the past, a view into the present, and maybe a view into the future with that horizon of peace that we cannot afford to forget as human beings, most certainly, but also as Christians. I think it's a place to understand. In order to understand the conflict, I've written out five commandments just for fun. We're on a mountain. We're going to come down from this mountain with five commandments, okay? We're not Moses. This isn't the Old Testament, but let's go for five commandments. So there they are. The first one is practice fair trade with information. And I'm wearing a T-shirt from my days at Lutheran World Relief, where the Lutheran World Relief Coffee Project, when I left, it was in about three, I don't know how many parishes, 2,000 parishes maybe were taking part in the LWR Coffee Project, to drink fairly traded coffee, at least in church, if not in your own home, and turn the tables a little bit on this very interesting product, which is the second most heavily traded commodity in the world, oil being the first, I think, but is grown by some of the world's smallest economic players. Small farmers grow this richest of crops and get a very poor share of the billions of dollars that coffee makes. To understand what's really going on in the coffee business, you have to ask yourself, who's not being served by the way it is organized? And who is not being heard in the stories that we hear about coffee? And if any of my family members are present, I'll only say this if they aren't. Go to Starbucks and let them tell you the story of coffee and ask if you ever hear the story of the farmers or if you hear the story of the mystique about the beans and the aromas, and all these impersonal things which gild their lily but don't actually help the people who grew it for them and for you. Ask yourself those things, and you start to get into fair trade. Well, I think you can also practice fair trade with information. I would say learn to look for bias. And if it's biased, do what probably most of you do. Don't buy it. Don't buy the information. Don't buy information if it's hurting the opponent of the person who runs away with the story. You get what I mean? If you're hearing a story and the main speakers, the main interviewees, are people who are coming out ahead from that story, and what they're saying is hurting their enemy, don't buy that part of it. Look for what's really happening, but don't buy the spokespeople that have been used. Another way to say this is always, who's telling the story? Who's served by the story? On the one hand, okay? And then to be fair, who's not telling the story and who's not served by the story? It's like the old adage, there's two sides to every coin. Our media often don't manage to give us the two sides. And in a case like this, it becomes a kind of an issue of life and death. In order to support fair trade in information and practice it, you've got to seek alternative sources. Just like in fair trade coffee, you can't buy from Starbucks unless you ask them to pull out their fair trade coffee and serve it to you. You've got to buy from a group like Equal Exchange, the people's T-shirt I'm wearing, and you have others in Seattle, the queen of coffee cities. You've got to buy from alternative sources. You've got to bypass the self-serving spokespeople. And you've got to bypass those who profit from the kind of spin that is passed off as real news or real coverage. So it's kind of tricky terrain, but I don't think I'm saying anything that you don't all sort of suspect and see, especially on this issue. So I'd really say don't give up being very skeptical about the mainline coverage and who is served by the stories you hear. I just take a little tangent here. When I first got to the Middle East, the first Gulf War was breaking out, and my Arab Orthodox boss, Gabi Habib, was asked again and again by the media, whose side are you on? Because on the one hand, you have Saddam Hussein. This was the August invasion by Iraq of Kuwait. Remember that, 1990? On one side, you have Saddam Hussein. On the other side, you have, you know, this coalition of powerful armies going there to kill some more people on top of the ones Saddam had killed. And my boss would always say, I'm on the side of the suffering. I'm on the side of the people who are suffering. And I think that's a very similar point to the one I'm making. Be skeptical about being on the side of those who are served by the story. Be brave to look for the side of those who aren't heard, who aren't served by the story. For me, that's fair trade and information. This isn't academic, because your understanding of a complex crisis like this depends on it. It really does. And your capacity to take action. I would say your capacity to live out your faith is also dependent on this. Another analogy would be to listen less to the middlemen. Fair trade cuts out some of the middlemen in the coffee business. Not that they're bad, middle women, middlemen, but it tries to go more directly to the farmer. Try to hear more directly from the people directly involved. Look for media that give you primary interviews with the Palestinian family that just got their house bombed, or the Jewish family that just got a Katyusha rocket into their living room. Listen to those kind of people as much as you can.
John.
Yeah?
I'm not clear which products tie into the Middle East.
I'm not pushing, I'm just making an analogy that the rules of fair trade are worth applying to your consumption of information. Okay. So the product is information. The product is information, if you like. But I led you too far down the path.
Okay.
If you're looking. We could go into oil, but I'm not prepared to talk about that. Is there any fair trade petroleum out there?
Yeah.
What would that look like? Fair trade with information is real tough, because our media have real small amounts of time and space for this stuff, and huge amounts of bias. I'm sorry, but I think mainline media in North America, almost to a person, have this problem of very little space for hard news, for world news, and huge amounts of built-in bias. So what you got to do is ask yourself what you're not hearing, look for it, and by coming here, in a way, I hope you're practicing fair trade without knowing it, because I'm trying to give you information you may not have heard in some instances from the main media that you listen to. Second commandment, stick to the facts, and I put in brackets facts on the ground, because facts on the ground in the Israel-Palestine conflict mean what's happening under the occupation of Palestine. And here's where I'd like, Lauren, if we could, to look at a map, which I think will help. I hope the people who were here yesterday had some questions about the history. I'm going to go into history in a minute. But my sort of soundbite would be, it's far better to trust satellites than spokespeople in this conflict. This picture is worth not a thousand words. This picture that Lauren's going to show you is worth, you pick the number, 1 million words, 2 million words. It's priceless. And what you have is three maps. This is Israel-Palestine in 47, 67, 2007. 47, 67, 2007. Of course, that means 2007 is the future. But unfortunately, the game is so well advanced that we can actually say what the future will be unless something changes. I said yesterday something about the 49 partition plan. I'll try to keep this as simple as possible, but this is the 47 partition plan. okay, before the first Israeli-Arab war. This plan was promulgated by the United Nations as a way to give away somebody else's land and sort of get away with it without screwing the local people too badly. This is what they came up with. And what's interesting is that they connected Gaza with what we might call Samaria, the Jewish terminology we know from the Bible is Samaria. Sorry, I'm wrong. This is Judea. Samaria is up there. I'm wrong. But connection here, and then a connection here between the northern part of Galilee and the central part of the West Bank. This was the plan that the UN came up with in 1947 when the Balfour Declaration of giving a national homeland to the Jewish people back where they came from, resolving this 2,000-year-old diaspora and all the troubles that went with it. Here's what the national community came up with.
What
are
you
so,
where
are you?
Right there.
It's about right. It's by the moment.
This could be a sophisticated form of censorship. So that's 47, okay? Now, to be fair, this is the Negev Desert. It's not worth a plug nickel. Unless you like desert and camping in the desert, four-wheel drive, you know, booming around in the desert. Wadi busting, they call it.
Yep.
Okay? So the Israeli settlers who were coming now, fleeing the Europe that had done them this horrible deed of the Holocaust, fleeing centuries of persecution, going back, you know, next year in Jerusalem begins to be a reality. They weren't getting that good a deal here. But I think it's a recognition that this was going to be a bit of a stretch to try to put another country on top of a bunch of people that already lived here. 1967 actually reflects very closely what happened just 2 years after that. Because in 48 they went to war, war broke out, and when the war was over, this is basically the territory that was in both parties' hands. Okay? Is that relatively clear? What happened in the 67, the Six-Day War, was Israel took over the gray parts as well as these greater cream-colored parts that it got to improve its circumstances from the 47 plan. So this was actually the map in the 1949 armistice. The pre-67 war boundaries are the same as the 1949 armistice boundaries. Okay? Ceasefire. The war wasn't settled, but they called truce, and they were living like this from 49 to 67. Then you had the Six-Day War, and they went all the way to the Jordan River, all the way to here, and actually all the way into Sinai, to the Red Sea in Egypt, way over here. And then if you remember, they gave up Sinai, this huge amount of Sinai here. They gave it all up, the part on the other side of the Suez Canal. They gave it back to Egypt in when? When Sadat and Begin made that peace plan. 78, I think, yeah?
Under Carter.
Yeah, where they got the Nobel Peace Prize, Carter and so here's 67, and the occupied West Bank and all the settlements and everything I'm talking about is based on this map. And these are the internationally recognized boundaries of Palestine, if it ever happens. However, Oslo didn't go back to this. Oslo Accords in 1993, an elaborate peace process, came up with a plan where this was divided up into Area A, where the Palestinians are going to be in charge, Area B, where there's going to be shared sovereignty between Israeli occupation and Palestinian PNA, Palestinian National Authority power, and then other areas still within the gray area that was still in Israeli hands. So they gave back pieces of the occupied territory in a very limited way, and it basically didn't work because they decided they'd do this to build confidence and didn't deal with any of the tough issues. And the tough issues are, what are you going to do about Jerusalem? What are you going to do about settlements? And what are you going to do about the 4 million Palestinians who are refugees in Lebanon, in Syria, in Jordan, in Egypt, in Detroit, in Australia, if they want to come home? Those are the tough ones. They didn't touch any of those. They just thought, we'll give back a bit of the land we've occupied and see if we can make it work. It hasn't worked. Oslo is in the trash bin of history. And what we got now is this. And this is 2007, basically, what's planned. And I won't go into it in great detail, but what you have is seven areas, basically, when you look at it, This has actually changed since I think this was drawn. Lauren and I didn't quite figure it out. But you can see that the Palestinians are supposed to be able to try to make a state out of this compared to that. And this doesn't show what is also offered, that they would actually link these areas up. They would dig a big trench from Gaza to Hebron, about 6 meters deep, 10 meters deep, steep, steep walls, just enough room for a train track, barbed wire on the top, and there'd be kind of a train going back and forth between Gaza and Hebron. And Palestinians who wanted to go from there to there would be able to get, maybe put their cars on, send their vegetables, visit grandma, whatever. Right now they can't do any of that. The 1.4 million people that live in this little piece of sand are stuck there. And the ones that live here are stuck there, and the ones that live in all of these pockets are stuck there. It's actually much more broken up than this shows at the present time, with roadblocks, with controls on movement. And of course, Jerusalem is completely missing from this equation.
Where is fence being built or building?
This is essentially the fence. That boundary right there is essentially the fence. In some areas, they're going to like cut across there, but they're going to still keep Ariel, this huge settlement outside of this the fence. And then when you and I have sort of lost interest, probably build a fence around Ariel as well, which is here. And the fence is the fence is all the way here and all the way there. And most of it's a fence, but when it's in a built-up area, it's a 6-meter-high wall. And if you put it between us and the hotel here where we eat our meals, you'd be hard-pressed to see any of that building, just to tell you what 6 meters. It's 20 feet, 18 feet, 19 feet, 20 feet tall. And we have paid for it, everybody in this room. If you're Americans, you've paid for it. So I think that everything we're saying and this idea of stick to the facts on the ground has got to be based on this is the experience of the Palestinian people and of the Jewish people who are trying to have security and live with the fact that they are kind of in the ascendant position here of taking over other people's land. Any other questions? Yes?
When the Balfour Agreement and they created the State of Israel, at that point, the Arabs attacked Israel.
No, Balfour was 1917.
Oh, I'm sorry. The 47.
They attacked fairly soon after this.
Okay.
When this was voted at the UN, there's wonderful films of Ben-Gurion and the Zionist leaders, you know, celebrating and celebration in Jerusalem where there were already settlers who had made it. Remember the film Exodus and that ship coming from Cyprus, Paul Newman, you know, before he got into salad dressing? I mean, fantastic stories, fantastic moment for the Jewish people to have this. And then the war broke, the first war broke out, the first 48 war, and when that was done, they had that. Any other questions? Okay. Lauren, thank you very much. Can you say where you found these, just for people who are interested?
Well, we got them on a disc when we were in a trip led by against house demolitions.
Uh-huh. ICAD,
but I guess you could go to ICAHD.org and hopefully you can find the maps. They're available in different places.
Yeah,
they are.
It's written on the board.
ICAHD.
Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. I'm going to talk about their boss on Friday or Thursday. Excellent. There's a Palestinian group called Arij, too, A-R-I-J, and I think they have it.
A whole series of maps that are just outstanding.
But, you know, it just changes the discussion if you're looking at that kind of information rather than, you know, whatever it is we have in our minds from the sort of spotty coverage that we get. Sir, could you hit those lights buttons again back there?
You might want to explain to those that didn't see the movie that there's roads interspersed through all this, too.
Yeah.
Bypass roads that bypass flyovers or you guys call them overpasses, over all of the Palestinian land into the Israeli land.
Yeah.
And they have the great highways that Palestinians can't go on.
Yeah.
Well, if anybody wants to see that map, I have that map on the computer. It's quite dramatic.
No, what's happened is it's an engineering solution to a political problem to the benefit of one side, which puts roads, bridges, underpasses, overpasses, allowing the settlers, you can be deep in the West Bank and be at work in Israel proper on the other side of the 67 borders in 20 minutes because you've got a brand new freeway that just goes whistling past all the Palestinian villages and has, where necessary, has barriers up so nobody can take a shot at you. You know. So it's easy to live anywhere on that map and work in, even in Tel Aviv, let alone Jerusalem. Yeah.
I was just going to comment that most of us, you know the Exodus story. For Palestinians, they call what happened in 48 the Al-Nabka, the catastrophe. And at that time, over 480 Palestinian villages were bulldozed, and others were confiscated.
Yeah.
Which created over 700,000 Palestinians as refugees fleeing.
Right.
There's a question in the back.
Yeah.
When the Jewish or Israeli state was approved back then, how did they all of a sudden have an army that they could do war with?
Well, they've been working on it through the British Mandate. You know, in the 30s, ever since 1900, Jewish people were going back to Palestine, even before the Balfour Declaration. And I think there may have even been a few communities still there from who knows when, the Middle Ages. And the numbers about who was there and who wasn't there are very sensitive. I mean, there's total disagreement about how many did the Jewish people stay there from the Roman conquest until now or not. So, but in terms of bringing people back, they created essentially militia. The Stern Gang, you've heard about. Jabotinsky, some of the Zionist leaders were militants, and they took up arms, and they went armed. And as the state came into view, as this partition plan was debated, this got heated up, and they'd been fighting the British who were running this ever since they took it off the Ottomans in World War I. So they were ready to fight. And they had armored cars and all kinds of things ready to go. And they fought pretty disorganized and unmotivated armies in Egypt, from Egypt and Jordan, and you know, small states without much power. And they really had a cause, you know, obviously. Coming out, remember, this is 2 years after the end of World War II, 2 years after Auschwitz got liberated and Buchenwald and all that stuff. So there was real force and commitment going on.
At what point did the United States become the major military supplier for Israel?
Only after the 67 war. We were suspicious of them because they were run by the Labor government, which was socialist. We didn't like them. We thought they were pinkos. No, it's amazing. For the first 20 years, there was very little support. And in the 67 war, they sank an American intelligence ship because they didn't want it to see that they probably launched the attack themselves. Although we're all told that they were attacked. That they sank the USS Liberty and killed 47 American soldiers because it was listening to what was going on. And so there was not a lot of love lost for the first 20 years. And I think it was all part of the, I don't know, maybe some of you who are a little older can tell us. I suspect it was all part of the shock. I mean, the world only started talking about the Holocaust in the 60s, I think, properly. So that part, I think, needs to be written. I'm not sure why they wrote it, because the Jewish American community was strong, but it hadn't perhaps organized in support of Israel the way it did. I'm not sure. I want to say that we're somewhere between those last two maps right now, much more like the last one than the middle one. And there are, at one point in 2003, there were 734 checkpoints, earth mounds, trenches, boulders across roads, roadblocks in that Palestinian area. Right now, I think there are 580. It goes up and down. But there are all kinds of controls to keep people from moving, even within the areas that we identify as Palestinian. And when you get to the roadblock, you run into an Israeli soldier. He asks you for your ID if you don't have the right paper. Like I told you with the guy yesterday with dialysis, you know. So people are getting they're getting stumped by the occupation in big and little ways all the time. There are also 200 settlements in that part, the gray part that was taken over, 200 settlements, about 400,000 people. You don't hear that figure all the time because East Jerusalem sometimes isn't counted as occupied territory. And on the seventh day of the Six-Day War, Israel annexed 10 times more territory than East Jerusalem had and annexed it and said, this is ours, no discussion. And so those settlers aren't always counted in the 400,000 total who are in the occupied territories. And so it's always important to say East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza. That's what's really on the table. And unless it's on the table, the peace won't last. If they make a deal without East Jerusalem, the peace won't last. So, you know, you can argue very convincingly that you're actually doing both sides a favor by being as honest as you can with the facts on the ground. Gaza, I will come to in a second because I want to go back and look at the orange sheet from yesterday and just read a couple things from that. But in Gaza, you have 8,000 settlers before they left last August. 8,000 settlers growing oranges, running hotels, resorts, taking up some of the nice beaches that are there, and using up more water and a third of the land in this 6-mile by 24-mile tiny little strip than the 1.4 million Palestinians who live there. When there were only 2,000 settlers in 1990, they were already using more water because they irrigate their oranges to a degree that takes more water than at that point it was 1.2 million Palestinians living there. Palestinians live in 34 towns and 8 refugee camps on that strip of sand, and their population density is 141,437 people per square mile. Anybody live in a 140,000 person town? Bellevue or not quite, huh? I heard Bellevue was 100,000 people. Where are all the Washingtonians when we need them? Anyway.
Well, that sounds right.
Yeah. So put those into two-thirds of a mile, two-thirds of a square mile. That's the density across the Gaza Strip. And they're trapped there. They're trapped there. They can't go except to Egypt through one little passageway that's now...
And is it where we are now to the old baseball field, about a mile?
Yep. Yeah.
Okay, between that and this.
Yeah. Yeah, put 141,000 people in a square between us and the baseball. Be a lot of people walking that labyrinth. Third one, understanding our involvement. And here, a little bit of history. I'll try not to get too carried away here. But basically, what I'd like to propose is that this is probably the best example of that adage we always hear, if you don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. Because the West and the Middle East have been repeating the same unfortunate cycle for at least 90 years, and it doesn't show any sign of fixing itself up. And you could argue it's more than that, because the memory in the Middle East of the Crusades, which took place when? 11th century, 12th century, so 1,000 years ago. The memory of the Crusades is still alive because of the history of Christian armies coming to take back the holy sites that had by that time been in Muslim hands for 300, 400 years. And the kind of worldview that goes on there. In certain kinds of Muslimized, not all of them, we have to be real careful to generalize about Muslims. They're humans just like us and they don't fall into one category easily. But in certain Muslimized, the statute of limitations on that crime is still not reached. The Crusades, and it's worth keeping in mind. The history I want to talk about is really from 1915, First World War, until now. And just to say that at 1915, at the time of the First World War, Britain and France and the major European powers had pretty much carved up Africa, Latin America, North America, of course, and South Asia, and incorporated them into the British Empire, the French Empire, the remainder of the Portuguese, some Spanish, and a few Johnny-come-lately German colonies. Okay, what they hadn't got yet, and as Europeans, I think we're all sort of indicted on this one, except a couple of you. As Europeans, they were basically controlling the world. And all they didn't have was East Asia, China, although it was this, totally falling apart, and West Asia, the Middle East, West Asia being the Middle East. And so the control of the Middle East was what they called the Great Game, where Russia was pushing down into Afghanistan. Does this sound familiar? Pushing down into Afghanistan. Britain and France were trying to take parts of it and get control, with India as the big anchor of the British Empire. So if you look at the map, you've got Europe here, the Middle East here, and India there. And from a British perspective, if they could do pretty well in the Middle East, they could hook up Europe and their homeland in Great Britain with this, the crown, the jewel of the crown of the British Empire, which was the control of the country of India with all of its people. World War I distracted them from this, but it didn't stop them working on it. And they came up with a scheme that I'll tell you about in a second here, in 1915, to sort of work out a solution for the post-Ottoman Empire period for the Middle East. The Ottoman Empire had been in charge of what we call Israel-Palestine today for about 400 years by the time the World War I came along, but centered in Turkey, okay, the very successful empire that went to the gates of Vienna in 1583, if you remember that, and then went off into the Middle East and into Egypt and controlled a lot of territory. This solution created states, quote-unquote, you know, drawing lines on a map and putting names on them. It set up rulers who were appointed by the European powers, and it drew borders to describe what those states would be. And you can say that the people weren't consulted, and they didn't accept it. And the question is, do they accept it still, the solutions that were imposed on them in 1915? You can look at it and say that the Gulf Wars are just a bump in the road. That unless there is an underlying fix to the issues that weren't addressed then, when this solution was imposed on the Middle East, unless there's an underlying, a basic fix to that, we'll keep having the kind of problems we've got. And again, this might all sound a bit much, and you're on vacation, and why am I saying these things, you know, when you're having a nice time in Holden? But unfortunately, we're Americans, and we have taken over the mantle of the British Empire ever since about the 1967 war. Increasingly since then. It was gradual, but now we are in the driver's seat in the same place the British were when they created this mess. I think that's what Tony and George were talking about with the open microphone the other day in St. Petersburg. Tony probably said, George, how are you doing with this mess we created down there for you? I think it's real instructive to just help you understand that this isn't just a nice story. There's a lot of facets which really bear out that idea that learn from history or repeat it. The British authorities in Cairo, who were sort of interested in linking up Cairo to India and had to then get control of this crumbling Ottoman Empire between the tip of the north of Africa there and across to India, they thought of Islam as a centralized authoritarian structure. That was the British colonial view of Islam.
Can I tell who was down there at that time? Lawrence of Arabia and Winston Churchill were down there at that time as young men.
Right.
A lot of them realized that this is real history, real people.
And Lawrence, the guy we like so much, is the exception because he actually identified with the Arab people much more than usual, although he used them, in a sense, to accomplish the British goals.
And there was a lady
goals.
There called Gertrude
Bell.
And there's a book she's written.
In the library.
She's
in the library.
Okay.
Yep.
Just want you to know, the real people.
They feared a Muslim holy war against British interests. They feared a Muslim holy war against British. Just change the adjective, and these sentences still work. They felt that Arabs were incapable of self-rule. The British authorities in 1915 felt that the Arabs were incapable of self-rule. And they never figured something out or weren't ready to admit it, that Muslims were willing to be ruled by other Muslims, but were not willing to be ruled by non-Muslims. And some of the calculation at the time was, well, the Ottomans were in charge of them, they're not Arabs, so we can take the Ottomans' place. The little kicker there was that the Ottomans were Muslims. And this new British Empire, trying to establish its place in their tracks, was not. Even though the Ottomans were Turks, they were Muslims. So you've got 1915, outsiders planning for a post-war Middle East. You ever heard that line before? Planning for a new Middle East? Condoleezza said it last week. This is the birth of a new Middle East. And you got to say to her, excuse me, Condi, how are you doing with some of these factors? Listen to what the British people, sort of a middle level executive, Sir Mark Sykes, he became a sir later on, and working with a French guy named Pico, came up with various ideas. First of all, they resurrected an old Greek term, Mesopotamia, and applied it to what we call Iraq today, and said, this will be a country. And they drew the borders of present-day Iraq. The ones that Saddam Hussein said are not meaningful when he invaded Kuwait, where Kuwait as a province was part of his part of the world under the Ottoman Empire. That was the rationale he used. I'm not defending him. But what he said wasn't totally nuts, okay? And in as we know now, to our own pain, in Mesopotamia, let's use the word, this old Greek, ancient Greek word, you've got Sunnis. Can you name all the peoples that are part of this grab bag called Iraq?
Sunni?
Sunni? You're not allowed to answer because she lives in Oman.
Turkmens?
Kurds. This guy gets an A. Kurds?
Shiites.
We got Shiites already.
Sunnis.
Christians.
Chaldean Christians? Anybody from Detroit? Half of them are in Detroit now.
Right.
Chaldean Christians?
Coptics too.
Pardon?
Coptics?
Iraq? Maybe.
They were there.
There's some people who follow John the Baptist. 50,000 people who believe John the Baptist was the Messiah and are somewhere between Islam and Christianity. There's a group called the Yazidis. Okay, throw them all together, call it Mesopotamia, now Iraq, and say it's a country. They took another old word, this time Roman, Palestina, and applied it to what we call Israel-Palestine. So they're taking a Roman word, resurrecting it 2,000 years later and saying, this will be Palestine. It was a British mandate over Palestine. They popularized the word Middle East, which had been invented a few decades earlier by a British naval historian. They designed flags for these countries that would appear after the war. That flag that the Palestinians have with the triangle and the three bands of green and white and red and a black, they got a similar flag throughout the Gulf. So they just took the same thing, changed the colors a bit, and said, okay, this will be yours, this will be yours, this will be yours, this will be yours. And then they played out the end of the war, an Arab British with Lawrence of Arabia. British forces, Australian forces, took Damascus during the course of the First World War. A guy named General Allenby took Jerusalem and thought of it as the Christian West taking back Jerusalem. He wrote about it in those terms, this British general who took Jerusalem.
Bridge named after him.
In 1917. Stupid bridge. An interesting thing is that this was a secret agreement in 1915, the Sykes-Picot Agreement, the one that laid out the modern Middle East. And an advisor to President Wilson, a guy named Colonel House, read it, and here's his quote. It's all bad, and I told Foreign Secretary Balfour of Britain, I told Balfour so. It's all bad, and I told him so. They are making the Middle East the breeding ground of future wars. This is a guy reading a secret agreement in 1917. The other element to talk about is Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, a Christian Zionist. He believed the stuff that Barbara's talking about in the Bible studies, about the end times, but also an empire builder and someone who thought that God's plan included setting up Palestine and didn't mind helping God do that, as well as extending the British Empire. You know, I mean, the parallels get kind of interesting here. So he expanded the British Empire, and I think the estimate is that when it was all done, he had 1 million square miles more in the British Empire because of the Sykes-Picot Agreement that they settled on there. In this same context, you have the Balfour Declaration, the exact same era. And the Balfour Declaration is, again, Britain, near the height of its power. When this was all done, the British Empire went from the Atlantic to the Pacific. I think the greatest empire in world history. 1922 was perhaps the high point, while this still held together for a few years. And in this same context, under the influence of Lloyd George and his Christian Zionism, the British Foreign Office signed, and Secretary Balfour has his name on it, the Balfour Declaration, which was a British response to the 20-year-old movement among European Jews who wanted to go back to the historic homeland of the Jewish people under the Zionist movement. And the declaration of 1917 is the Balfour Declaration, promising a national home in Palestine to the Jewish people. So again, I said yesterday it was a colonial project from the 19th century. I hope we wouldn't allow this today, even though we're accomplices in its consequences now. But you're essentially saying, in a colonial mentality, we got colonies all over the place. We've taken other people's lands as if it was ours for at least 200 years now. What's a little bit more? So let's give this to the Jewish people, and they can have their home back. But there's a clause in the Balfour Declaration that's really worth reading. It being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of the existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine.
How can that be?
Yeah. You know, the first law of fair trade and information is when you hear something that doesn't make any sense, don't forget that it doesn't make any sense. You know, don't forget if it's impossible. You can have a state, but you can't do anything to prejudice the rights of the people who are already there. So it's like the thing was doomed from the beginning. Now, were they unintelligent or were they cynical, devious? It's hard to say. It's hard to say. And the kicker is, if Lloyd George was really believing, and I think he was, his Zionist, Christian Zionist, end of times mentality, it makes it a little more complicated than just saying he was devious. Because an ideology that drives you in the wrong direction is a more difficult motivation. Now, it's real interesting to look at the last 70 years that happened, or 90 years that happened since that time, and sort of say, well, how are they doing with this scheme, Sykes and Pico, Lloyd George, Balfour, and the rest of them? 7 years, just Israel-Palestine, 7 years, many, many, many riots, two uprisings, countless killings, countless dead people. We're still living with the consequences in Israel-Palestine, the part that they call Palestine. Okay, all that we're talking about is, in effect, the consequence of this turn in the road. Already by 1919, the place was kind of popping. There were riots in Palestine. Iraq was separating between the Sunnis, the Kurds, the Shias, and the Chaldeans. Afghanistan was being chopped up between Russia and Britain. And for Saudi Arabia itself, you had the Hashemite kingdom, who can lay claim to being descendants from the Prophet Muhammad, and the House of Saud, who can do the same thing, having it out over who would control how much of the Saudi Arabia. And that's before they knew that it was full of oil, I think. And then very interestingly enough, and again, one more parallel for you, you're being very kind to listen to all this ancient history. Guess who was in charge? Somebody already mentioned it, Churchill. And guess what he did when these Iraqis started getting a little bit uppity? It was right after World War I, and it was pretty hard to get an army together and send them out there, because World War I was a horrible, horrible, horrible experience for everybody involved. And the casualties make what we suffer today look like, you know, no comparison. So Churchill said, we've got airplanes. We've got bombs. They sent airplanes to strafe and bomb the Iraqi communities that were rioting. So the West started already in 1919 to use air power to enforce the solutions that it had chosen for the people of the Middle East. And that's kind of what we're still doing, you know? We think that we can do this by technology, basically, by smart. Now it's all that much better, but they were using biplanes and bombs. And then during the Iraq invasion of these last 3 years, some of you have heard about it. Maybe you have sons and daughters in a town called Kut, K-U-T. You read about it in the news? It's off on the eastern side of Iraq, and there's been some incidents there. Well, the British suffered an incredible massacre of their own soldiers in Kut, because the people in Kut managed to do sort of like Fallujah on the British at that time. This is all becomes kind of a tired story. Muslims rise up, bomb them down. They look like they're acting together in all these different countries that weren't so happy after the solution was imposed. But they're actually all acting from basically the same dynamic without even talking to each other, because it's that much not relevant. To make a little bit of a summary here, you've got the Iraqis or Mesopotamians revolting against the British. You've got the Palestinians against the increasing Jewish presence authorized by the Balfour Declaration before the State of Israel as they began to settle in the Mandate under British control. You've got the British in charge in Egypt, and you've got reactions to them in every place. And this idea that between 1915 and 1922, Europeans decided how the Middle East should be in order to replace the Ottoman Empire with something to their own liking. 80 years later, powerful local forces still don't agree with that. They weren't consulted then. They aren't consulted now in many cases. And unless we sit down and talk to the modern-day descendants of the folks that don't like this, which means Hezbollah, which means Hamas, you can trace those, some of those movements, the Muslim Brotherhood behind Hamas, for example, right back to the same period. An old, old movement of self-determination, of dignity, of Islam, being in control of itself. Things that we, I don't think, can argue with. We enjoy the privileges that we are denying them. And they go with human rights, they go with national self-determination. And it's interesting to say that there were four states created and two that probably should have been created in this solution. The four states created, listen to them. You're tired of them. Iraq, Israel, Lebanon. Jordan is the winner as the most peaceful of the four. Okay, but the other three are kind of always in the news, always flaming. Iran was already there with an identity. It had been also part of the Ottoman Empire, but it had more of its own identity, and that's a separate story. We put in the Shah after they tried some democracy that we didn't like. Pardon? Syria was a French colony, a French protectorate, just the way that Jordan and Palestine were British. The French got a little buffer to keep the Russians and the British from wiping each other out. The two that weren't created were Kurdistan. I think I'm right in saying there are 20 million Kurds in the world, or maybe 40 million Kurds. I think it's 40, actually. They're stuck with Turkey. And if you know the news there, they've been fighting Turkey for about 20 years. So Kurdistan, and there's Kurds in Iraq, Kurds in Syria, and even Kurds in Armenia, I think, or Azerbaijan. Kurdistan wasn't created, and Palestine wasn't created, the Palestine for Palestinians. And Israel was created later, not in 1917, but in the same momentum in 1947. The final... I've got two commandments to go. Maybe we'll just do one more. Identify causes, watch trends. I think this is really, really important because all we get in the news are symptoms and events. We rarely get causes and trends. And again, I have to be a slightly critical of our leader and say the other day our president made a point of saying we've got to get at the terrorism, which is the root cause of the problem. You know, I've done media work, and I know that on his paper it said, you've got to say root cause, you know? And so here he said root cause. That's not the root cause of the problem. If terrorism is the root cause, God made devils instead of his children here. People don't become terrorists out of the blue. Of course it's a crime. Of course it should be punished. Of course they should be given a trial and, if necessary, put away for a long time. But to say terrorism is a root cause of the trouble in the Middle East is to pretend that nothing that you've just heard is true and that the situation we have today is just a question of pounding. You know, you're carrying a hammer, everything looks like a nail. Hit it harder. Hit it harder. I would encourage us to think about causes and trends. Let me give a couple examples. Here's the story you always hear. Palestinians refuse to negotiate peace. The Israeli foreign minister said at one point in the 60s, they never miss a chance to miss a chance. And that story gets told over and over and over again. And for many of us, Yasser Arafat is sort of once, you know, that far from being kind of a tragic clown, tragic idiot, you know. But because that's the only story we hear. I'll give you a soundbite alternative, and it's really just a soundbite, but it's rock solid. Two people are sitting at a table. In between them is a glass of water. They're negotiating over the glass of water. One of the people at the table, while they negotiate, either has the right or just takes the privilege of drinking from the glass that they're negotiating over. And he just keeps on drinking. But they're still supposed to keep negotiating over that glass of water because they both want it. And he just keeps on drinking. Which party is which? That's a trend. That's not an event. That's a trend. And into that trend, you can put many of the stories that you hear. So when Arafat at Camp David is pilloried for not agreeing to what Clinton and who was the president, the prime minister of Israel at that point? Shamir?
Begin.
Barak. No. Barak. He gets accused of passing up this incredible deal. He knew that he could not go home with that much water that was left in the cup that they were going to give to him when the settlement was done. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to the maps we heard. The 67 boundaries, the international, are 22% of historic Palestine. Palestinians are willing to settle for 22% of historic Palestine. The Arab League is willing, the whole Middle East is willing to settle for 22% of historic Palestine. The final map is about 10% of historic Palestine. And their failure their refusal to agree to 22% means that they will now have to settle for 10 if this one-sided unilateral imposition takes place. Okay, but it's all about that glass of water, where the water represents land, it represents livelihood, it represents movement, it represents their future, it represents water itself, because the water in that dry part of the world is in aquifers underneath the Palestinian occupied territories. And whatever is going on here is, don't give up control of that water. Take it and use it in the other parts that don't have it.
Jonathan?
Yeah.
One of the Palestinian lawyers uses the term a pizza. It's like negotiating for pizza while somebody's eating it.
Yeah.
So I've taken that metaphor further and gotten pizza trays from a pizza place and actually cut it so people could see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it starts out with, you know, about 3/4 of the pizza Israel has. But, and so now I say that basically out of the 10 slice pizza under international recognition of territory, Palestinians have agreed to accept 2 slices left as being theirs. But the way that settlements have gone in and the bypass roads and the security zones, it's taken in effect 1 of those slices of pizza. But the reality is, because it's not all contiguous, the Palestinians are like the pepperoni slices left on those 2 slices of pizza.
That's good.
And so that people can visualize it.
Yeah. Second story we always hear is more people killed. Just fill in the blank. 32, 29, 18, 4, 5, 7, 9 killed in the Middle East in violence in Gaza or Lebanon or where. More people killed, more people killed. In this second intifada, a trend would be to say that the thing has gone far enough that the only people willing to fight are the extremists. The average person is kind of given up. Not given up their hope, but given up. They're not willing to go out there and shoot and fight. But because the extremist Palestinians, the militant Palestinians, are fighting with weapons, increasingly heavy weapons, whatever they can get their hand on, they then tar the whole bunch, the whole group is tarred with their image. When in fact, the second intifada has not been a popular uprising. If you remember the first one, they used stones and they used nonviolence. They used strikes and curfews to not participate in the occupation. This one has been, you know, much uglier. With militants fighting soldiers on the Israeli side, militant Palestinians fighting soldiers on the Israeli side, and the killing should be understood in that context as a desperate, extreme. You could say extremist on both sides because the occupation is an extreme project, very extreme project, and nowhere is that more apparent than Gaza. Why did they withdraw from Gaza? Because it simply didn't work. They're supposed to have 30,000 settlers there by now. All they could get was 8. Even with the best low interest mortgages, even with the orange groves to work in, vegetables to grow, greenhouses to have, they still couldn't get people to settle it. They finally gave it up. In a trend that's actually quite potent right now.
Oh, tell what they left there when they left. What did they leave when they left?
They took
everything with them. I mean,
yeah, they crunched. They didn't crunch all the houses. They crunched. They took the synagogues out. And anyway.
No. Crunched
off
the houses and left the synagogues, which then that left the Palestinians in a terrible
awkward
situation that went through those synagogues.
Oh, I thought I saw one synagogue boulevard. Anyway, we need to stop. Yesterday, I gave you an orange piece of paper, and what this was it was us trying to say that, okay, Gaza doesn't work if you think of it in the terms that it's being described as, where, look, we're withdrawing from occupied territory. Now we can do what we want. We're doing the right thing. It's better to say, what are the trends going on here? And the trends we put down is, will the life for people in Gaza improve? Will the people who are withdrawn from Gaza be resettled on other occupied territory or resettled in Israel proper? Trying to be hopeful and positive here, you know. From now on, decisions affecting both sides need to be negotiated by both sides rather than imposed by the more powerful side on the weaker side, which is what happened with Gaza. They just left and said, good luck, and kept the borders and the control and the sea space and the airspace under Israeli control. Negotiate that if you want it to work. Don't just withdraw and say, here, go for it. Fourthly, both sides need to treat that most sensitive of places, Jerusalem, as a shared and open city. I said yesterday, two peoples, three faiths, one city. Palestinians in the West Bank need to be able to travel between their communities to carry on this idea that Israel is pulling back. Can they travel? Can they move? The international community needs to meet its obligations to bring peace, because we're all implicated in this. The United Nations has spoken about the solutions. The political will to move isn't there, and we are the people in the driver's seat as United States citizens. Fourthly, the last sign, seventh sign, Israelis become more secure. Because I think the issue of Israel's security is possible to solve without taking it all out of the backs of the Palestinians. In fact, it'd be far more security gained if the Palestinians got half a deal rather than an eighth of a deal or a tenth of a deal in terms of building towards some long-term security. And I will have a little reading from the Lutheran bishop in Palestine to close with, but I think we're out of time. Maybe those who need to go can go. Those who have questions, I'm happy to stay for a while. It's a bad sign when nobody's got a question. Or a good sign. Let me read this to you if you're still here. You stayed for 12 seconds, so I'm going to read it to you. This is Bishop Munib Younan, and he's talking to a group of American congresspeople and their aides, and many people who are not in agreement with the kind of thing you've been hearing from me and you would hear from him. Bishop Munib said, no form of peaceful settlement of the conflict will ever be realized unless the grassroots, the people on both sides, will be reconciled with one another. In this task, the three monotheistic religions are called to be the forerunners, preparing the way for reconciliation. At the moment, both nations are polarized with both political and religious extremists from the three religions forcing the two peoples apart from each other. But those extremists must never kidnap the Middle East, nor kidnap justice, peace, or reconciliation. I believe that that religion should be an instrument of peace and a broker of justice. Religion is to call Palestinians and Israelis, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, not to see God only in ourselves and our own religion, but also in the others, in the people who are different from us. When we learn to see God in the other, then we accept the humanity of the other. Once we accept the humanity of the other, then we accept the otherness of the other, and then mutually recognize each other and our human, civil, religious, national, and political rights. Only then the Holy Land will become the promised land of milk and honey for both Palestinians and Israelis. I think words like that do a pastor proud, do a bishop proud, do us proud, give us hope, give us a sense that there is a way forward and that we have to resist the kind of despair, apathy, tune-out, burnout, whatever it is that is so easy to have. And I hope that, I haven't really explained this one, but it's pretty obvious, and Munib's doing it right here. Nothing we say is valid unless we can say it to our enemies as well as to our friends, and unless we can finish it with an affirmation that we are looking for the best interests of all the people involved.